Maybe some of you remember the popular song that then was used as the theme of a movie in the 70s, People Get Ready. Do you remember this song? And I remember when I first became a Christian, I loved this song and all the different versions it came in. But that idea of people get ready, the reason is because, you know, there's a train coming. God is coming, and when he's coming, there is this readiness that is required. I think I've mentioned it before, but in my growing up, my grandmother used to have this saying, anytime I was doing something a little bit obnoxious was, you know, we want to be found doing that when the Lord returns? And so the second coming of the Lord, in my mind, and I think in some sense, rightly so, scripturally speaking, was this frightening and somewhat daunting thing, and there was this reality that when he comes, there's this readiness that is required. And that is clear even in our text this morning. But the question before us is, what does it look like to be ready? I mean, what is it we're to do in order to make sure that we're watchful servants who are prepared for the coming of the Lord? Well, I want us to see, at least hopefully, an answer to that question under three headings this morning. The obvious, the odd, and then the opposite. The obvious. It seems there are certain parts of this parable that are really clear, very easy to understand. The plain command of the parable is to be ready. It begins with this call to action, and it ends, so also be ready, for you don't know when the Son of Man is coming. You'll notice there are two exhortations, that the servants are to gird themselves for action, and they are also to keep their lamps burning. I'm sure you know or have heard at one time or another what this means. We don't typically speak like this, you know, gird yourself for action. But in that day when they were wearing tunics as their normal dress, if you were about to go do something vigorous or something that required some sort of manual strenuousness, you would then gather up your robes and tie them into your belt so that you would be ready to do something somewhat active and not get tangled up in your clothing. And so here, the master of the house is coming, and the servants of the house are to be there prepared, you know, ready to work. Maybe we would say it in our own day, you know, you roll up your sleeves and be prepared. Well, also, they're to keep the lamps burning, you know, to keep the lights on. You don't know when he's coming. You don't know if he's coming in morning or in the night watch. And so make sure the lights are on. And again, this is something that's a little weird for us because we have electricity and you just flip the light on if someone comes in. But if you live in a time when all the light that is provided comes through the light of oil lamps, you don't want to start trying to light those when it's already dark. Maybe some of you backpack or camp, and you know full well that, you know, especially if you don't have flashlights at the ready, if night falls and you're not prepared in camp, the darkness becomes a whole nother, burden in order to get things going. And so these servants are instructed to do two things. You know, be prepared for action, have the lights on so that you can serve, because you just don't know when the master's coming back. So the first thing is a call to be prepared, and the other obvious thing is the reason. This is the master's returning. You'll notice we're told the reason they have to be ready is because the master is away at a wedding feast. You know, he's gone out of town. Maybe it's in town somewhere, but a wedding feast, biblically speaking, was not like ours, you know, one night of celebration, but oftentimes could be up to a week long where you would go and really join in several days worth of festivities. So the master has been away. He's been at this feast, and he's going to be returning home, and you need to be attentive and ready for his return. What we don't want when he comes back is, you know, all the lights off and the door barricaded and the master, you know, left outside in the cold. And so these two ideas, again, come through to us clearly and fairly simply. You don't know when the master's coming back, so be ready. That's the obvious part of this parable. Then there's the odd part. Maybe you noticed there's a couple oddities in this text. What do, you know, after all of this talk of getting ready, all of the stress to make sure that you're prepared, what do the servants in this text actually do? You know, they're told, you know, get your clothes ready, have the lights on, you don't know when the master's coming, and when he comes, you know, be ready to spring into action. And when we read the parable, the servants in the house don't actually do much at all. I mean, the entirety of their workload is they open the door and they let the master in. So, you know, it seems like a little bit of an overstress, like, hey, guys, make sure that everyone is on board. You know, you got your checklist ready. Be dressed for this because you're going to have to open the door when the master comes. It seems like a fairly simple task. It seems like, again, overkill as far as the parable goes. But that is what we're told, that they open the door and let the master in. And if that's not odd enough, what's really odd, what turns this parable into a bit of a mystery, is not what the servants do, but what the master does. I mean, far more absurd is what happens next. The master's been gone at this week-long party. You know, he returns home after 7 days of probably daily wine drinking and festivities and sleeping in someone else's home, you know, and he's beat. He's coming through the door, you know, his bags and luggage, and they open the door to him, and he goes, you know what, guys? Everyone sit down. I'm going to cook for you. We're all going to have a feast. I'm going to make all the food. You guys just sit there. Don't do anything. You recline at table, and I'm going to serve you. And the master, we're told, girds himself and begins to serve the servants as they recline at table. That's insane at one level, and Jesus knows it's insane. I mean, in Luke 17, in the same gospel, Luke knows what he's doing here. Jesus actually says, will any of you in chapter 17 who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he comes in from the field, come at once and recline at table? He says, you know, what kind of master, just because your servants go out and work all day, when they come back in, says, you know, let me fix you dinner? He says, no, that's not what you do. You say to them, hey, I'm glad you worked hard all day. You fix me dinner. And when you're done, then you can sit down and have your own meal that you've made. But that's not what happens in this first parable. The master's been gone all this time. He comes home and he says, you guys sit and I'll serve you and fix you a meal. That is what, normal masters have their servants serve, and normal servants do the serving. So in that sense, there's some oddities in this parable. There's the obvious, be ready, because the master is the returning. There's the odd, you know, servants who don't do much serving, and a master who does a tremendous amount of serving. And then the last thing I want us to see, and don't get too excited, the last thing's a long thing, no, is the opposite. The opposite. Yeah. As we've mentioned before, and probably came up in the Luther Sunday School that I was not privileged to attend, Luther says, or has taught so often, that God always works under the opposite. What we would normally expect, what we would do if we were God, just think of what you would do if you were God, and if you want to know God's way of dealing with things, do the opposite of that. So, you know, when we want to show, you know, if we're in charge and we have power, we exert that power and we stay in charge. If we're a master and have slaves, guess what? When the slaves come in the field, from the field, they make us food. You know, everything that comes naturally and normally to us, which is you achieve greatness by being great, God says, no, you achieve greatness by being the least. You know, we think, well, I'll be happy if I just keep accumulating. God says, no, if you want to be happy, it's better to give than to receive. All of the ways that come to us normally, all of our natural instincts, God's ways are the opposite of that. And we see that profoundly in this parable, not just in the way that God works in the parable, but in what God requires of us, the way that we have to work, what we would normally think is required. When we think, well, what kind of life do I have to live? What kind of activity do I have to be about in order to be ready for the Lord's return? We'll see that both of those things, both the way that God works and our way of working, are utterly and completely 180 degrees wrong. Notice how the parable makes this abundantly clear. First, we see God for us. Well, it may be subtle at first in Luke's gospel. Luke isn't trying to hide this interpretation. This isn't something I'm sneaking into the text. Luke's pretty plain in the way that he writes his gospel of how he wants this parable interpreted. Luke's already told us, for instance, that the kingdom of heaven, the goal of the kingdom, ends at a meal, right? He's told us that there's come this day where the sons and the daughters of the kingdom will sit down at table with God. So he says that's where all of history is heading. It's heading to a table. This is a short commercial for the Sunday school class. It's heading to a table where we will eat and drink with God himself. We know of it in the New Testament as the marriage supper of the Lamb by the time you get to the book of Revelation. But Luke has told us that history ends at a table, and then he's told us in his whole gospel, Jesus keeps eating with the strangest people, right? Tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes. And everyone's angry because when Jesus sits down at the table, he sits with all the people that you shouldn't sit with, right? He's loving the opposite sort of people that we would love, and he's welcoming into his table, into his kingdom, the sorts of people that we wouldn't naturally think to welcome. And so for a second coming parable that's telling us what's going to happen at the end of history, in one sense, it shouldn't shock us that it ends with a meal, right? The master comes back, and he tells the servants to sit at table and recline there. Well, in one sense, that's not so shocking because Luke has told us that's where history's heading already. In this meal, he describes the master coming back and serving his servants. You'll notice he tells the servants, gird yourselves and be ready. And the first thing he says the master does, the master girds himself and he serves. And so we have, if you will, a parable about the end times. And the end times ends at a table. Luke's already told us that's going to happen. And then he gives us a little more detail about what it's going to look like when it's happening. But Luke will also tell us how to interpret this text by another meal that he's going to tell us about in his gospel. So yes, God is going to feed us at the end of history and we're going to sit at his table. But Luke shows us another meal in his gospel where God is seated and uses language directly from this parable to make sure that he's trying to tie the two together. In Luke 22, when he tells his disciples, I've greatly desired to eat this Passover meal with you before I suffer. So what's the context? Jesus is eating the Passover meal in which he's going to give to them the Lord's Supper. It's the meal that he's partaking of right before his death. And he says at this meal in Luke 22, verse 27, for who is the greater? Who's greater? The one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Now in the parable, what's the answer to that question? Notice, he's lifting the language straight from this parable. And so he asks his disciples, who's greater, the one who reclines or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. Now, and think about what he just said and take it seriously for just a minute. He's talking to his disciples who this very night are all going to betray him. And he says, who's greater? The one who gets to sit and be served or the one who serves them? He says, the ones who sit are clearly the greater ones, and I'm the one serving you. And then Luke says the only thing he does in service at that table, notice, Jesus does not prepare the meal. He doesn't set the table. He doesn't, you know, get out the placemats and the table settings. He doesn't light the candles. The only action he takes in this scene in Luke 22 is he takes bread and he breaks it and he gives it to them. And then he takes wine and he pours it and he serves it to them. Thus defining his service. His service to them is giving them bread and wine, but that bread and wine is nothing less, of course, than his body and his blood. So he says, you become great because I'm serving my body and my blood to you. His great service, of course, as the servant, is the death by which they are fed. In a meal where he serves to them bread and wine, he tells them that he's going to give his body and his blood for them. And ultimately, according to Luke, it's them partaking of that service, right? Whoever partakes of his flesh and his blood will never die. Whoever partakes of that first meal, whoever eats his flesh and eats his blood, whoever drinks the wine and eats the bread in faith, will also be seated at that last table where Jesus comes at the end of time and sits his family down to recline. And as the master serves them as the great ones, considering them, if you will, better than himself. He will make them masters at his table by becoming a servant. And what he serves in order to make them masters is his flesh and his blood on their behalf. And if you think, one, that's not in the parable, or if you think this parable is crazy, if you look at Luke 12 and you say, that's odd, a master coming back and serving his servants, that pales in comparison to what Jesus actually did. I mean, that is nothing in comparison to what it means for God to put on human flesh and be crucified in our stead. I mean, putting on an apron and serving a meal is one thing, surely showing some humility. But being God and joining himself to our condition of humanity, the infinite putting on finitude, and more than that, not just putting on our humanity, but suffering the death that we deserved. Suffering what Zephaniah that we read this morning is talking about, this judgment that's coming to the world, the fact that God's going to do this cleansing. He coming, God himself coming under that judgment in order that we might be seated as masters at his table. It really does pale in comparison. Luke tells us something about the master in this parable. That yes, he is so great in one sense that he's willing to serve his servants. But he's also telling us that the service that God gives to us in his incarnation doesn't end in the new creation. Jesus isn't putting away his servant-like ways. Notice we confess as a church that God, that Jesus Christ will be God and man forever. That the Lamb who is slain will bear the marks of his murder for all of eternity. The only one scarred in the new creation will be God himself. And God will not relinquish himself of that humanity for all eternity. That he will be one with us in our humanity the entire time of the new creation. Meaning that the service of Christ on our behalf isn't just something he does for 33 years and then he relinquishes it all in order to be only, divine. But he will be glorified as God and man for all time. If we think the table service in this text is offensive, we have to buckle up because, of course, we haven't seen anything yet. The way that we are served by them there in this final scene is all because of the way that we are served by him here in the judgment scene of the cross. That is what Luke is trying to tell them. He says, so this master comes and serves, and then Jesus just happens to be, breaking bread, and he says, just so you know, who's greater, the recliners or the server? And I just want you to know that I'm the server. Again, uniting himself with this parable and defining for us who's here. Well, if that is the opposite for God, what about us for God? What should be expected of us? If our normal way of thinking is, if you are God, then show yourself to be great. And God says, I am God and I am great and I'm going to make you masters and I'll be a servant. Well, what does it mean for us now? Us called to follow him. What is expected of us? As soon as we hear that, I think I start flooding back to my own, preconceived notions of God. Well, if God is coming back and he's coming back in judgment, we'd better get busy in doing, and if we don't do the right things, then that judgment scene for us is going to be excruciatingly painful or, the very least, humiliating. But if it is that sort of God who returns, a God who continues to serve, what does that sort of God require of us in our role? Notice he says, be ready. gird yourself, light your lamp. Surely these are all things that must be done. But of course, in the parable, they don't really do much. Once they've gotten prepared, they open the door to the master. And it's interesting that Luke here uses this phrase to gird oneself. It's a phrase that's used originally for the very first time for the people of Israel on the night of Passover, just by chance. When they were to eat in haste, he told them, "Gird yourself and be ready to go, for God is coming to deliver you this evening from your enemies." It was that God who commanded them in the Exodus that he was going to be their deliverer that told them to be ready for his deliverance. What was their role there? To put the blood on the doorpost, to eat quickly, and to be ready to do what? To receive the deliverance of God on their behalf and to be set free. Your job, if you will, is to be delivered. I mean, you're going to see that over and over in Luke's gospel. What does readiness look like? Readiness looks like someone who, A, knows they need deliverance and looks to the God who gives that deliverance. We've already seen how he gives it. He gives it in, you know, bread and wine, in body and blood. And our duty is to receive it, to be ready to receive Christ, not only then, but now as we wait. I mean, that is how we get to the final meal. We get to the final meal by believing on the Lord Jesus Christ. And if you think this is a stretch, think of how the New Testament uses this language from here on out. Notice what Peter says as he repeats the call of the Lord here in this text. He says, "Therefore, girding up your minds for action." So again, it's action words. Get ready. There's something to do. What does Peter say? Be sober-minded. He says, get in your right mind, right? So be ready for action. Be sober-minded. We're thinking this is good, right? You know, if you're getting ready for war, you know, you get yourself all girded up. Don't be, you know, this is not the time to be drinking too much. We've got to stay on high alert. And he says, here you go. Set your hope fully on the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ that will be brought at his revelation. So when he says, set your mind on action, prepare yourself, gird yourself, he says, here's what I want you to do. Hope fully on the grace of God that will be ultimately fully revealed when he returns. The action that we're to take, the sobriety that we're to have, is to be sober-minded enough to know that we can't do anything. To be realistic enough to know that all of our acting and all of our trying will be insufficient to please God if that's what we're counting on. Peter's exhortation is be fully reliant upon the grace of God that will be revealed when he comes. A sober mind, Christianly speaking, biblically speaking, is the same sort of confession, you know, that AA confesses, right? What's the first thing you need to know? That I'm completely powerless over my addiction. The first thing a sober mind, biblically speaking, says, I cannot save myself and there's nothing I can do that will be pleasing to God. That I need to wholly rely upon a God who is kind and merciful to sinners and is willing to deliver any who spreads the blood of the Lamb over the doorpost and is ready to be saved by that sort of God. To have a clear head is to have a clear mind about what you need. And what we need is grace from front to back and top to bottom. To keep your hope fully on the fact that God and God alone is coming to save you. And how do we know that it's true? How do we know that God is going to save us? How do we know that we're ready in this way? Because God is requiring us to believe. That is what's being asked of us. Be ready. And to be ready is to have, you know, your hope fully set that God is going to save you. Well, what does God use to make sure that we continually are ready in that way, that we're still believing? He says, here's some bread and here's some wine in order that you might know for certain that you're trusting in me and that I am for you. Every time we eat the Lord's Supper, we proclaim the Lord's death. We'll get into this in some detail, but notice for Paul, eating and drinking surely are verbs, no doubt, but when he says we proclaim the Lord's death, He's not saying that we do anything verbally. We're not saying anything. We're doing something. We're eating something and we're drinking something. And when we do that, we proclaim Christ for us. What's he saying? He's saying every time we do that, we're putting blood right over the doorpost and saying, I want to be protected by that Savior. And he is for me. And by taking him into myself, I believe in him. And thus, we know that we are saved. And maybe it's too simple or it's too silly. Maybe it's too little to think that what God requires of us is simply to trust that he has done it all, will do it all, and will come to deliver us. The reason it's too simple and too silly is because it's not what we would require. It's not what we would do. But God always works under the opposite. Our faithfulness surely is required, but our faithfulness is a result. It's not a condition. It's something that will take place. What does it look like to be faithful in this age? To keep on repenting and to keep on believing. And what God uses to bring that about is words spoken, bread and wine given, and a weekly coming together where we acknowledge once again we are in utter need and we need to be sober-minded about the fact that we just aren't going to make it on our own. And God says, in this is life and protection and security. In this, we see the master who serves his servants, not just at the end, but even today. God is here to serve you. I know it's hard to believe, but he just doesn't need anything, much less something you could offer him. And so instead of expecting something from you, he comes here to give you exactly what you need in order that you may be found in him. So may you receive it this day from his hand, and may it be for you a protection from all that is coming by way of judgment and end times. You know, what is it required? What do you need to do to be ready? Just eat some bread and drink some wine, and you will be secure. Let us pray.